Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Startup Societies Foundation podcast. Today, we are joined by Max Borders, the Executive Director of Social Evolution and co-founder of Voice and Exit. Max, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, and I'm really happy to be with you.
Excellent. I want to talk to you for a long time. Voice and Exit's obviously an inspiration for Startup Societies. You spoke at our conference. So for people who are not familiar with Voice and Exit and Social Evolution, can you give a brief rundown of what those projects are?
Sure. I guess most people are usually representing one entity, and I have too much fun with two, so I'll do my best. Well, first, I think I'll start with Voice and Exit. It's an annual event held in Austin, here where I live. It's co-founded by me and a friend of mine, Seth Blaustein, who is a talented filmmaker. We decided we were on about 2012, I guess it was, that we really wanted an event that would mix the intellectual with the aesthetic and to some degree the spiritual, you know, a completely holistic event devoted to humanity's flourishing. It seemed like, you know, TED was an interesting thing, and TED was a good model, and certainly we doff our hats to TED. I mean, they're wonderful. They're the reigning champions of this space. But we really felt like we could do something different and present ideas that were a little more radical in a lot of ways. And so that's what we did. And we're now in our fifth year and really looking forward to having people who are interested in all aspects of human flourishing come out to the event. And particularly, there's a big focus this year on technology, particularly the distributed ledger, cryptocurrencies, and so on. So there's an emphasis on that we cannot deny this year.
Well, excellent. I've heard a lot of people describe your event as Burning Man plus TED. Could you confirm or deny that allegation?
Well, having been to Burning Man for the first time this year, I'd say that is incredibly flattering. Burning Man is out of this world. I guess you could say it's imbued with the touch of the aesthetic and the spirit of Burning Man. And so I'm happy to take that if people want to attribute it. And yet, it is very much a baby next to the scale of Burning Man, but I think it's fair. I think it's a fair assessment in the sense of it being participatory, of it being open to radical ideas. And certainly, the aesthetic nature of Voice and Exit is something that, if you go to Burning Man, you would notice as well.
So can we unpack the title itself, Voice and Exit? For our viewers who do not know, what do you refer to when saying Voice and Exit?
Sure. I really would, this is a great chance to give credit, I think. I think the first time I ever learned about the term exit, voice, and loyalty, which is a sort of the original formulation of this, was on a reference to a blog, I'm pretty sure, on the Let a Thousand Nations Bloom blog that was started by Michael Gibson, who's an incredibly talented thinker, writer, and venture capitalist. Back in those days, he had pulled together some people like Patrick Friedman and others who were sort of thinking about competitive governance. And they were appealing to, I'm pretty sure it was something that Arnold Kling had written. And Arnold Kling had written about this fellow, this old Harvard prof named Hirschman, Albert O. Hirschman. Hirschman wrote a book in, I think it was 1971, called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And the basic idea behind the book is if, just talking for a moment about the first two, if you don't, generally speaking, when we think about voice is the idea of expression. If we don't like something that we're in a system we're in or something that we're participating in as a community, we exercise voice to try to get it to change. We do that through democratic process. We do that through expression. We might go out on the street with pickets. We might say, hey, I don't like that, boss, whatever. But if that doesn't work, then the next option is exit. That is, we leave the system and we end up, you know, we go into a situation where we might try to start something new. And so the algorithm, and then of course there's loyalty, which is really unpacking the idea of, you know, fidelity to a brand or fidelity to a nation or whatever the system is, and that sense that people can be loyal beyond the other two aspects. But in focusing on voice and exit, really, I call it the human algorithm. We really wanted to unpack the idea that this is really how social change is made through these two mechanisms. We exercise expression or we exercise exit. And that's pretty much it if we're talking about peaceful interactions.
So one of the taglines of Voice and Exit is criticize by creating. Does that sort of indicate that you prefer exit over voice in that formula?
To some degree, yes. Although I think it's in many respects is a yin yang phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say there's a preference for exit, except if we're talking about really, really talking about status quo that isn't working. I think our current political situation is a status quo that isn't working. So in that context, I would say, yes, absolutely, I prefer exit as a mechanism. But I really am very much a fan of voice as well. In fact, the whole event is predicated mostly on voice. I mean, people come together and express themselves in interesting ways to brainstorm, to learn about what each other is doing, to listen to speakers. And so it's a celebration of voice in that respect as well. So I wouldn't say that I have a preference for it in the abstract either way, but certainly our contemporary political situation is such that I prefer exit. Let's figure out ways to get out of here, to get out of this situation and build alternative structures that could be superior in a lot of ways. And of course, that's why I love talking to you, Joe.
So what are some more alternative structures that you find the most exciting, Max?
Well, I think there's so much going on right now that it's absolutely dizzying. And in fact, I have I've sort of appropriated a term I ran across, and I don't know if I use it in the same sense, but I'm happy to use it for my own purposes. And that's the social singularity. I believe that just like with the singularity, the technological singularity, this is a theoretical point beyond which we will no longer have the current arrangement of human social interactions, or the social operating system upon which we run will have fundamentally changed within a few years. And I think that is analogous to the singularity in that, you know, once we get to that point, there's sort of no turning back, I guess you could say. So one of the things I'm most excited about, obviously, is startup societies. This can take a number of forms, one of which is special economic zones, which you guys are fond of talking about and exploring. I think there are private and sort of more politically oriented forms of this that we have to look at both of those. There could be hybrid forms. There's seasteading, which is, you hack the law of the sea and position floating platforms 24 miles off the coast of some country in a zone that is sort of safe for exploration with new rules. And sometimes it can be closer in, depending on the arrangement with the country in question. But ultimately, the idea is experimentation with new rule sets. Our social operating systems really are analogous to technologies that give rise to X. We don't know what X is. I guess we should say N, because it could be any number of things that these social technologies give rise to. And so when we think about special economic zones, we think about competitive governance, we think about trying new rule sets and new territories, there are just so many ways to go about it. And I don't think we can be too doctrinaire about that. You know, some of the criticisms of startup societies and competitive governance is that it's meant to be sort of like some sort of libertarian escape hatch where, you know, rich people like Peter Thiel build their utopias or something like that. But it's really not. In fact, people who are much more heart-centered, I guess you could say, are much more concerned with the plight of the poor and the dispossessed, are starting to look at these alternative structures. People like Vinay Gupta has recently come out in favor of refugee cities. There are just so many options, and I think we should, as Michael Gibson would say, let a thousand nations bloom. And that's really what's most promising about the idea of territorial governance per se. where territory is, you know, loosely thinking of, you know, a place on a boat or a place on land or a place somewhere, where terra is literally land from the Latin. But what I mean is, you know, we tend to think about rules as being contiguous with territory or mapping onto territory somewhere, someplace. But we don't need to think that way anymore either. And that's really the second interesting part of this. But I'll shut up for a moment in case you wanted to interject there.
No. Please go on. I want to hear about non-contiguous governance. I assume that you're talking about applications of blockchain technology, or just take it away from here.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one great example. It would be a blockchain. The particular technological instantiation of it could be through the blockchain. It could be through something else. I think there are a lot of interesting models to be developed in the future. I'm curious about, for example, a new one being developed called Holochain. And, you know, it has a bit of a different approach to than the sort of the cryptocurrency model that started with Bitcoin.
Can you explain that? Is that the one with Moritz Berling involved?
Well, he's been a sort of a cheerleader for it. I think it was founded by a guy named Arthur Brock, and I'm still learning about it. Suffice it to say, though, if you can't ask me about the technical specs, I couldn't look under the hood and tell you anything because I'm not a techie. So I'm really curious to get very bright techies to look at what they're doing. But essentially, if you think of the blockchain as being total disintermediation, that is, cryptography replaces people altogether. What strikes me about Holochain is that there is some of that element of that. It doesn't depend on the entire system, the entire network, in order to complete that computation. You know, this is sort of resource intensive and cryptographically heavy. But anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Suffice it to say, though, is the way I understand Holochain is that it really introduces the element of the crowd or of checkers, or the ability to have sort of recursion with checkers of different stripes. And that means the intercession of people doesn't go away as it does with blockchain. It just involves the radically peer-to-peer intermediation. Is the way I understand it. I'm going to leave it at that, though. I'd rather someone like Arthur Brock talk about that, and you should invite him on your show to find out. But fascinating to me is the idea of traditional mediating structures that tend to be centralized being broken up, whether that's through cryptography or whether that's through cryptography plus the crowd, however you want to look at it. There are applications, I think, to both of these approaches to decentralization that are interesting and necessary. I think of it in terms of, I don't know if you've ever looked at the Myers-Briggs, but mm-hmm. The last letter of the Myers-Briggs is J and P, which is, I think,
is it judging and perceiving?
Judging and perceiving. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And the judging types, I imagine to be more blockchain oriented.
Right.
We're black and white, very very algorithmic, very yes or no, binary, on, off, and middlemen are not involved. Human interactions are easily undertaken through sort of the rigorous logic of the blockchain.
Even blockchain experts are starting to back down from that sort of mentality. I mean, after the DAO, the first DAO by Slockit was hacked, they sort of moved away from this idea that smart contracts will be the bulk of the legal system. Don't most acknowledge that there'll be at least some human interaction with most of these contracts?
Yeah, and I think we have to go back to Madison and think about mechanisms for multiple checks and what does that look like? I mean, there's an opportunity to introduce and infect systems with groupthink, which we don't want to do.
Right.
But Holochain could be, or some other technology could be, a way of doing that in interesting ways. And I'm going to get out of my depth, and I want to admit that right now. But it is promising, and here's why. So I'll go back to where I am comfortable, and that's the level of theory. There was a guy named Dupuy, who was a Belgian philosopher, operating in the right around the the time of Bastiat and of Marx, and he came out with a little tract called Panarchy. And the idea of panarchy was that you could adopt your chosen system of governance from your bedroom slippers. Now, that seems rather odd to us today because we always think of rules being attached to territory. But if you think about the adoption of rule sets, if you think about public goods as such being considered instead club goods, you could have alternative governance structures being shopped to you every day. Different governance structures. So we don't have to be faithful to a specific form of governance. We might not, you know, like think that a purely price oriented system of healthcare, for example, patient centric system, is the best way. We might think, okay, I like the Swedish system better, or I like the Swiss system, or I like the Singaporean one. Anything that begins with S, you can choose. But the idea then is that we can select from a menu some governance structure that makes sense to us, because there's no reason whatsoever except an accident of history and conquest that a rule set be applied to a certain patch of territory. And if that's the case, and we're living in an age where we can introduce and adopt governance structures through these market mechanisms and have them be more or less, we can count on them more because of the blockchain or some other mechanism. I think we're going to be entering an era where much of what we tend to think of as governance as territorial monopoly on the initiation of force is going to be replaced with more like a competitive club goods model. And I'm really looking forward to that.
So I am totally there with the optimism, but I'm going to push back a little bit. Sure. and simply ask, so how can we maintain governance divorced from territoriality if you have to constantly deal with the concept of sovereignty? Sure, you can have your parallel governing structures, but if the state doesn't respect them, while they may not always be able to completely destroy them, they can certainly make them much harder to exist. In that sense, even though maybe domestically or in working like with person to person, we can deal with these parallel governance structures, don't we need a territory if only to adjudicate disputes with adjacent territories?
Well, and look, here's the thing about, I make a distinction about this in an obscure paper I did a long time ago, but suffice it to say, there may be things that we think of as, instead of thinking of public versus private, we may have to think of governance structures as being territorial versus non-territorial. Mm-hmm. That might be one meaningful distinction that we come to eventually. We might also think of there, you know, we might also in our dealings with these sort of the private provision of governance or through some other, you know, mechanisms where I choose one system, you choose another. We are encouraged or even have to, by virtue of being members in these organizations, agree to certain kind of arbitration mechanisms. And I believe that if this isn't chosen as a matter of for us by fiat through some power, it will evolve naturally. There has to be a stopping point. Otherwise, it becomes too costly to enter into these situations. You could just get eternal recurrence. And so there's a cost point beyond which, the adoption of these sort of alternative governance structures will be too expensive, I guess you could say. And so everyone is going to have an incentive to make sure that there's arbitration of some sort. And I have no doubt that those structures would evolve. They already have in some sense. There's a lot going on the sea that suggests this to me. And there's insurance and other mechanisms that will complement those third-party mediating structures, even if they are, or third-party mediating agencies, even if they're necessary. Some of them will be, and some of them won't. Some of the algorithms for smart contracts will be pretty simple, and people will adopt those at lower cost. And if we need the P's to come along in the Myers-Briggs sense, and we need more information to make a good judgment about this, and you want the intercession of third parties, those will be available, and hopefully there will be checkers on that with the wisdom of crowds rather than the arbitrariness of a ruler, I guess you could say.
So let's end on a semi-utopian route, and I want to ask you how these social or political technologies can be used to influence other technologies. I know you're a big fan of transhumanism, for instance.
Well, let me go to one thing before I move on to that.
Of course.
Because I think it's really important to directly answer the question about these legacy governments and their interests and their power. They're not going to let it happen, you say. There's a book by James C. Scott called Two Cheers for Anarchism, which I would really encourage a lot of people to pick up. He gives me hope in this. He has a passage in the book where he says, "Quiet, anonymous, and often complicitous, lawbreaking and disobedience may well be the historically preferred mode of political action for peasant and subaltern classes, for whom open defiance is too dangerous. One need not have an actual conspiracy to achieve the practical effects of a conspiracy. More regimes have been brought piecemeal to their knees by what was once called Irish democracy, the silent, dogged resistance, withdrawal, and truculence of millions of ordinary people than by revolutionary vanguards or rioting mobs." See, that passage to me, if you think about that passage in that, the idea that if you look into the past and see that some of the changes that have happened over time have been as a result of this Irish democracy phenomenon, imagine then empowering all these people with cryptographically protected phones. I think we're going to see that first in the developing world. And once the developing world leapfrogs us and begins to adopt, for example, more cryptocurrencies, because the benefits to doing so far outweigh the risks to them in their current situations. Whereas for us, you know, our currency is relatively stable. We may bitch about it, but compared to living in Argentina or Venezuela or in sub-Saharan Africa, the adoption of these technologies is definitely worth the risk and definitely superior to what they're coming from, I mean, by a wide margin. So that's the form of Irish democracy that I think is going to sort of gobble up these old structures. It's going to be like the universal acid, as D.C. Bennett put it, about evolution. It's just going to begin, it eats through everything because it is superior. And when you have millions and millions of people using superior technologies, it's really, really hard to roll it back. And we can see that in something as simple as Uber.
How do social technologies influence other technologies? I know you're a fan of transhumanism.
Gotcha. I think what we're going to see, I've been arguing this for, God, 20 years, and it's amazing to me that people like Elon Musk are coming out as if it were some big hairy deal or some novel insight. But the transhumanist movement has been very much of the mind for a long time that we're going to begin to see the marriage of mind and machine. And that is to say that we are going to augment our minds and brains with computing technology so that the idea that a robot or artificial intelligence and human intelligence are discrete categories is going to begin to blur in time. And the more it blurs, the more we merge our minds with either other minds or other computing devices or both, the less of a distinction we're going to have between us and them, real intelligence and AI. So in advance of that, as we begin to come close together through peer technologies, we're going to see the benefits of collective intelligence, the likes of which we have never seen before. This is really the social singularity aspect of it, because it's going to improve our collective intelligence. However, that is going also to be happening in parallel with this blending or merging of our mind brain with artificial intelligence. And once all of those phenomena start to merge, i.e. pure technologies, artificial intelligence, and the like, we're going to, what currently seem like fixed categories aren't going to be fixed categories at all. And that makes me heartened. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. I do think it will eventually happen. And I do think humanity will be much better for it.
All right. Excellent. Thank you, Max.
Thanks for having me.